Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast with as much verve, enthusiasm, and excitement as a James Milner after dinner speech. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, to discuss all things sport is Mr. Will Moulton.
I find James Milner's parody Twitter account very funny.
Well, I bring this up because did you see his post-match comments last night?
No, I didn't. I was otherwise engaged.
So, 3-3, Liverpool versus Arsenal, and he did the post-match interview, and he said, "We need to be more boring," and Twitter went into meltdown.
What a man. He's right, though. I think Liverpool do need to be a little less boring defensively. A little more boring defensively, sorry.
Absolutely. So it was an entertaining watch, but yeah, they cannot defend. If you're new to the Sportspiel podcast, here's a brief outline of how it works. In the first part, myself and Will, we'll go through some of the biggest talking points from the last 2 weeks. However, as this is the last episode before Christmas, and also the last episode of 2017, we're going to have some festive fun and do something a little different as we go back and pick our best, worst, funniest, most memorable, inspirational, and game-changing moments in sport over the last 12 months. We'll then follow that up by dishing out our regular virtual awards, our Outstanding Display of the Week award, and our Feel Good Story of the Week award. The second part of every Sportspiel episode is our feature interview section, where myself or Will holds an in-depth one-on-one interview with a star from the sporting world. On this episode, Will spoke to British steeplechaser Rosie Clark about her career, becoming the best in the country at steeplechase despite doing it for just 18 months, and also the dietary requirements required to be a top athlete. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. Well, let's crack on into our first section as we go back through 2017 to pick out our best, worst, funniest, most memorable, inspirational, and game-changing moments of the year. And we're going to start off with the low points because I think we like to get a bit more positive as episodes go on. So we're going to start off with the worst.
Indeed.
So, how this is going to work? You're going to give your worst and I'm going to give my worst, and then we'll chat about stuff and see where we go from there. So would you like to kick off with your worst moment of the year?
Indeed. So there were a few to choose from. Russia sort of entered my mind, but then I thought we've talked about them enough on this episode and it's been going on for quite a while, more than a year. So I decided to go for the entire Ennio Luca saga. So the accusations of racist comments by Aluko that weren't properly investigated by the FA, and then the whole lawsuit and the settlements, and then coming out and finding that they hadn't interviewed the right people, and then finding Samson had said them, and then sacking him. And it just basically, with women's football taking such a positive step forward over the last few years, including this summer with the Euros, and you know, Jodie Taylor putting in that fantastic performance and winning the BT Sport Action Women Award, there's so many positives from women's sport, but then this was just a massive kick in the face. Fortunately, the actual on-field action has not taken too much of a dip from it. The Women's Super League is still going strong. England are still performing well. But it just highlighted how inept our FA is. And it just was horrible and ugly and messy.
Likewise, Russia entered my mind. But again, I went for the exact same thing with the Mark Sampson sacking and the whole Ennio Luca saga. And pretty much as you just said, women's football is something we both desperately want to see grow and do well, and a lot of major steps were being made in that direction. And it did highlight the ineptitude, the lack of common sense in our governing body. Yep. And to see something like that played out, firstly in the media and then in a parliamentary committee, was not what you want to see. And I've said this before on this podcast, massive kudos to Daniel Taylor at The Guardian for the work he put into actually exposing this and pushing this, because without his work, I don't think we would have actually seen the right conclusions. If essentially it took three investigations to find out what really happened in the Ennio Luca affair.
It was such a cover. It was such an obvious cover up. Yep. Because for the first two investigations, they didn't investigate. They didn't speak to two of the sort of main culprits who would have been on Aluko's side. And like, you watch any TV drama, or even like fictitious or real, you know that you have to, for a decent investigation, you have to interview everyone and yep. exclude every possibility. And it was just like, it was such a such an obvious cover-up, it was painful.
And in the end, Mark Sampson was sacked, not for that, but for past misdemeanours while he was Bristol Academy manager. And that was a report that hadn't been seen by FA senior management for 2 years.
It had. They just decided to ignore it.
It was a very convenient,
in my opinion, though,
convenient reason for him to get the boot from the FA, I think. That's comfortably our worst moment.
It was also with the whole FA, the way they followed on from the Sam Allardyce fiasco of last year, and then with the whole Greg Clark and talking about bringing out homosexuality in sport, and he's like trying to force it upon them. And I feel like we do need to make football and sport in general a place where people who are gay and participating or watching or whatever can feel comfortable. But he was trying to force it upon them. And I remember Tom Bosworth, the race walker, who is openly gay, coming out and saying like he was basically trying to create a gay day. It just shows they've got no idea. They've got no idea of how the world works.
Not a good day. Not a good year for the FA, I think. Before we move on from worst, I'd also like to give an honourable mention to several West Ham United performances, which I've had to endure as a fan in 2017.
And Liverpool defensive performances as
Liverpool
well.
Liverpool defensive performances.
In there.
But try watching Joe Hart try and save a shot. Anyway, moving on to a far more positive note. Sorry, Joe Hart. Funniest moment of the year. We're going to uplift this podcast. Do you want to throw me your first funniest nominee?
Indeed. So I was tempted by the own goal overhead kick in the Swiss league that's been doing the rounds recently,
was quite
funny. And also Jordan Garden of Cowdenbeath, who conceded a penalty with a head first tackle. It's just one of the strangest things you'll ever see. But then I remembered, actually related to our guest interview, Rosie, this week, in the women's 3,000 metre fight steeplechase final at London 2017, Beatrice Chepkwech of Kenya, one of the favourites leading the race, on the second or third lap, decided that she just wasn't going to run the water jump. And some of the athletes followed her, and then she ended up having to go back and doing the water jump, dropped to the back of the field. It was just like, she's an elite athlete. She's been doing this for how long? And she's forgotten to take the water jump? Like, I know it's slightly not on the beaten track, but...
See, I'd forgotten about that until you mentioned it.
I remember watching it with my dad, and we were just thinking, what on earth? How can you forget? And she came fourth in the end. It was quite a good attempt because she was so far, she lost so much time. But
imagine if she's just taken the jump.
Oh, dear.
My first nomination for funniest moment is a recent one. I don't know if anyone has seen, or more importantly, heard the Inter Milan Christmas song, which is entitled Inter Bells. It's truly tragic, and I'm going to play an extract of it now. So, yeah, truly tragic. Javier Zanetti leading the chorus of woefully out of tune Inter Milan players.
I used to have so much respect for Javier Zanetti before that.
Conducted as well by manager Luciano Spalletti.
I never had much respect for him.
I doubt has ever conducted a choir before in his life. But yeah, I'm also going to throw forward as funniest Denis Shapovalov for his quite outstanding hit where he smacked a tennis ball into the face of the umpire during the Davis Cup match between Canada and Great Britain in February.
With hindsight, that's hilarious.
That's the thing. I said this to you before. With hindsight, it's hilarious. If the umpire had suffered a severe injury as a result of that, he could have died, in fairness, then this would not be in funniest
but the thing
category.
Is the size of the area he was hitting it towards, the fact he's managed to hit the umpire in the face is so unlucky.
That's the thing. So unlucky.
So unlucky.
He got disqualified as a result of it, and I think Britain ended up going through on the back of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, massive learning curve for Denis Shapovalov, and quite an entertaining video still. Anyway, moving on to number three, and that's inspirational. Your inspirational moment of 2017.
So, I'm a bit biased here because I work in hockey, but earlier this month at the Hockey World League finals, Barry Middleton won his 400th international cap. That means he's played 400 times for England and Great Britain combined, and that's just
he's
only the fifth player in hockey ever to do so. And it actually came in a thrilling 2-2 draw with Australia, which was a fantastic game. And you know, he's one of the most humble men you'll ever meet. Frustratingly humble as a journalist, but you know, I remember seeing him watching his wife at a game earlier this year, and he was just sitting up at the top of a stand, and he was just in plain clothes, and you know, people were just ignoring him. I'm like, that's the great Barry Middleton, but he could not care less. And I remember my colleague asked him about, you know, what's it like to win your 400th cap, and he was just like, yeah, it's just another game, effectively. And it's, but the man is just a legend of not just British hockey, but hockey in general, and everyone has so much respect for him. And you know, he's still going strong. Tokyo 2020, I think he's going to be there. And yeah, just with all the histrionics and all the dodginess in certain other sports, you know, to have someone like him, just a normal bloke who just happens to be exceptional, winning 400 caps and everyone having respect for him, is just an inspiration to us all.
Oh yeah, that is massive kudos. If you were making that many appearances for your country, be it England or Great Britain, you must be pretty damn good at your sport.
He is.
I had two stories that were going through my head as most inspirational. One is Billy Munger, the racing driver who we mentioned on the very first episode of this podcast that we ever did, because that was shortly after he suffered the crash where he ended up losing both of his legs. But to see the way he's come back from that and the drive he's showing to continue racing, as well as the charity work he's doing, and also people like Lewis Hamilton giving him the platform that he needs, I think that's a very inspirational story. But as admirable as that is, I think there's only one winner. And it was a story that was honoured as Sports Personality of the Year last week, and that is Bradley Lowry and Jermaine Defoe, which we've mentioned a fair few times, and how that relationship between the pair of them before Bradley Lowry sadly passed away was one of the most amazing things we'd seen for a long time. And is really, results aside, what sport is all about. Yes, Sunderland, results-wise, were pathetic last year, but to have that story was really uplifting, and it made a little boy's dreams come true.
It did indeed, and it was horrible circumstances to see that come about, but the way Jermaine Defoe and to be fair, the Sunderland, Everton and the entire football community came together to support him was something special. And in a sport where everything is just going nuts at the moment with terms of, you know, FIFA corruption and money and all sorts, to see something like that was just truly special.
Oh yeah, and to see the work that Bradley Lowry's parents are still doing for children with neuroblastoma, it's really, really inspirational, and they'll probably continue for years and years to come. Moving away to number four, and this is game-changing moment of the year. Fire away.
So as many of you listeners regularly know, I'm quite big on promoting women's sport and getting women's sport, as you know, seen as equal to the men's. And there was rugby is one of them, and there was just one moment this year during the World Cup where I thought, you know, this is going to change it. And it was the semi-final actually against France. So women's rugby has a bit of a reputation of having certain sides who are a million times better than their opponents, and they just walk through them. And we saw that in the group stages. England and New Zealand especially strolled through their groups. They weren't tested. But England came up against France in the semi-final. We know France are a good team, and that was one of the best games of rugby, men's, women's, you know, any I've ever watched. The pressure France were putting on the English defence, the way the English defence resisted, and then they hit them on the counter, and it was a low-scoring game, but I could not take my eyes off it. And my dad was watching it with me, and he's never really watched women's rugby before. He's always derided it a little bit, and even he was saying, like, this is a brilliant game. England then went and lost the final in another fantastic game against New Zealand. But now everyone's taking it seriously. You've got the Tyrrells 15s. You know, so much attention was paid to the England women, their recent series against Canada, in which they destroyed Canada. But, you know, I think from that moment on, people are now going to start taking women's rugby seriously. And the fact that was on ITV at prime time, you know, free for everyone to watch, it was, I think women's rugby is going to go from strength to strength, especially in this country.
Certainly game-changing. And while we're on the subject of women's sport, actually, this is something that's been put on Twitter quite a lot, is the BBC Sport Advent Calendar. Yeah. 22 days in, I can't remember what is on today's, because we're on day 23 now, hadn't featured a single women's sport.
Part of the reason for that, though, is the BBC, like, you can't always get access to this footage because other people own the copyright, and sometimes it's not possible. And the BBC don't show a lot of women's sport. So, for example, I don't think they could get anything off Channel 4 for the women's Euros. I don't think they could probably get anything off ITV for the women's rugby. They couldn't. BT aren't very good at keeping their hockey records, so I know there should have been more on there,
but sometimes
they've been able to get access.
Yeah, sometimes the logistics come to.
I feel like the BBC Sport calendar this year hasn't been as good as recent years as well.
Mm.
They've certainly not promoted it as much as they used to. So I feel like we shouldn't go so hard on them because there probably are reasons. They probably wanted to include some stuff, and you know, there would have been so many good things from the para athletics to include, because you know, Hannah Cockcroft, Sammy Kinghorn, Sophie Hahn, Sophie Kamlish, the list goes on.
But all Channel
but
4
that
footage.
Was all Channel 4. And what did our women do at the Worlds? Well, the women's 4x100 did win the silver, but then you had the men who won the gold in the 4x100.
Exactly. So in terms of achievement, what are you likely to put?
Yeah.
But no, I understand that point.
But it is frustrating that there isn't more women's sport.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We hope that will change in the future. But anyway, back to game changing. And I went for Neymar's transfer from Barcelona to Paris Saint-Germain for a world record £198 million. Game changing. For the fact that it proves football has gone mad in terms of money, and that money is absolutely no object. It has inflated the market to catastrophic levels. As we saw, Kylian Mbappe will be signed in the summer by Paris Saint-Germain again for around 130 odd million. He's currently there on loan. It raises questions about financial fair play and the loophole that Paris Saint-Germain are currently exploiting by loaning Mbappe in the first place. Ousmane Dembele, who was bought by Barcelona to replace Neymar, 20 years old, £97 million. That would not have been the case if
they
that transfer had happened.
They did have the money to buy him,
though. Well, when you get given £198 million, that's quite a lot you can spend. And also the fact that Philippe Coutinho, at your team, Liverpool, couldn't be signed by Barcelona, despite them offering around £120 odd million. Pounds.
I'm not complaining at that one.
I'm sure you're not. But yeah, that is game-changing, because I think signifies to me money is no hurdle, financial fair play isn't really a thing.
No.
And also the influence that Qatar have in football at the moment,
something
not just the World Cup,
something
we discussed, but the fact that they own Paris Saint-Germain as well and will quite literally do anything to put themselves
They've
at the top of the
big
game.
They've got a stake in the Premier League somewhere as well, haven't they?
They do, and in the FA.
And in the FA.
So yes, I think that was one of the biggest, most game-changing moments that we've seen. And football will never be the same again, I think, after that. But moving on. Topic 5. Most memorable moment in sport.
There's a few. The one I've chosen for my best moment almost came up in this one, but but most memorable. I was in the stadium to see Johnny Peacock win his 100-meter T44 title. That was pretty special. I was in the stadium to see Hannah Cockcroft win her third gold medal of the World Para Athletics Championships. But I was also in the stadium, alongside yourself, to see Sammy Kinghorn win her first ever world gold medal at London 2017. I remember what I was like. I'm sure you remember what I was like. I was genuinely so nervous for her before. And, you know, we'd interviewed her and, you know, I'd been really inspired.
I think it was the week before she was on, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'd been really inspired by her story because I'd seen her at Rio, didn't know her story. And then, you know, you learn her story and you chat to her. And I've had knocks in my life. You've had knocks in your life. But compared to what she had and what she had to go through and the way she's come back and the work she's done, she's an inspiration to us all. And then following her career and doing that interview with her, you just wanted her to do well. And then going out, seeing her win that gold was really special. And that's a moment I don't think we'll ever...
Oh, yeah.
I remember I don't normally get that emotional, but I just remember screaming at the top of my voice when she won and being so happy for her. And that was really memorable moment. Yeah. I won't forget.
Well, if we're going back to game changer of a moment she's had in terms of her sporting career, a game changing year.
Oh,
she's won every award going.
We were lucky, I think, to have her on the show.
Oh yes. So a reminder, everyone, you can go back and listen to that episode and find out Sammy Kinghorn's story in full. My most memorable one, and this is probably down to the fact that I did a politics degree at uni, for which I apologise for. It's not the greatest of dinner conversations. Well, what did you do at uni? I did politics.
It's better than saying I ran round in circles and jumped up and down like I did at uni.
That's true. But anyway, in terms of the political thing, for most memorable, I went for the NFL protests against Donald Trump after the US president labelled players that knelt for the national anthem as sons of bitches and then called for them to be fired if they did that. And of course, NFL players, particularly black players, have been protesting about the inequality in the United States at the moment, and that will stem from Colin Kaepernick, who was of the San Francisco 49ers, started off the protests, and is still to get another team. He's still unemployed, as it goes, because I don't think any team really wants to take the risk in hiring him. But I think, again, that was nearly in game-changing, but I think that'll be most memorable, because I think that's really started something that could go on for quite a long time, particularly with Donald Trump in the Oval Office right now.
Indeed.
But on to the last topic, and we're going to leave the best to last, quite literally, because it's the best memory of 2017. Fire away.
Again, women's sport is something I've championed a lot over the last couple of years, and especially women's cricket, and it can only be that World Cup final. There was a few moments where England had struggled in that tournament. I remember the semi-final against South Africa really springs to mind, where they sort of scraped through, and in the final itself, despite Lords being packed out, you know, for the first time in a long time for any cricket, you had millions watching and listening. England looked like they were going to sort of slump to a defeat, and then Q, Anya Shrubsole, with one of the finest bowling spells you'll have ever seen in a game of cricket, given the pressure, given the context, given where she was, given how potentially game-changing this tournament was for women's cricket, what she came out and produced with that bowling spell to win the World Cup was just unreal. I remember exactly where I was. I was sitting in my room at my desk. My mum was cleaning the bathroom. She had the radio on. I had the radio on in my room. Dad was in his room doing some work. We're all listening on our different radios, and we'd all sort of given up hope. And then Shrubsole came on, and we were all listening. And when she took that final wicket, we were just all like, "Wow!" I wish I'd been there to watch it, but the fact is, I was listening to it, and it was just special, really special.
Oh yeah, and it was special, and it was very nearly my best moment as well. Particularly because I'm no fan of cricket. I've said that many times, but that was actually exciting because I sat down and watched the last 15-20 minutes, which, as it turned out, was the best part of that match to watch. And what she did on that day was incredible. But it's not my best moment. As I said to you, I thought about the combined England youth football World Cup wins, so the under-20s and the under-17s, primarily because of the hope that it brings for England as a nation. There's a lot of young, talented players there, particularly Phil Foden of Manchester City, who won Young Sports Personality of the Year last week. He's got a lot of talent, that boy, so I hope we get to see him fulfil it. But, as I said to you, when I was looking for a best moment of the year, I wanted something era-defining. I wanted something history-making, which is why the cricket final very nearly came into the equation. But as you've criticized me for, I've gone for an American sport again, and I've gone for the NFL again, and I went for Super Bowl 51, which was history making and it will be in the history books for quite a while, I think, because it was New England Patriots against the Atlanta Falcons. Atlanta were leading 28-3 at one point, and then courtesy of a Tom Brady inspired comeback in the fourth quarter, New England scored 19 points to none and hauled it back level. So it went into overtime and then they went and won. And that was the biggest margin anyone has ever come back from in a Super Bowl. And it was it was the most amazing final period of a match I think anyone has ever seen. The amount of people that went home in the third quarter thinking this game was done and dusted, considering the margin, definitely regret it now, considering how expensive it is to get seats there. And Tom Brady, doubts about him as a person, but as an athlete, considering he's 40 years old, he's still the best and probably will go down as the greatest quarterback of all time. And that game defined him and his team and that team's legacy. History making, and that's my best moment of 2017.
And the moral of the story from both? Don't leave or give up until it's officially over. Because in both cases, yeah. You know, one team looked down and out, and in both cases they came back and won.
Good moral. I didn't even notice that.
Good moral.
It's never done until it's done.
Exactly.
Right. That is it for our roundup of 2017. But don't forget, we have our two virtual, prestigious awards to dish out. Outstanding display and feel-good story. Which one do you want to dish out first?
Should we do outstanding
display? Let's do outstanding display, which on this occasion is being awarded by myself. And considering a lot of the sport has kind of died down at the moment, there was one that really stood out for me in the last week. And again, we're going back to football, and Premier League football in particular, which we don't talk all that much about, because quite frankly, there's enough podcasts that do that. And I went for Kevin De Bruyne of Manchester City for his performance in the 4-1 trouncing of Tottenham last week. All round quality performance. He got the second goal in that game as well, and he is quickly becoming one of the world's best midfielders, definitely the best player in the league right now. And I think it will be poor form of us, a sports podcast, to not mention how stunning Manchester City have been this year before 2018 arrives, because they are breaking all manner of records. They've won 17 games and drawn one of their 18 games so far. They're on 52 points. They're 11 points clear of second-placed Manchester United. They're totally rewriting the rule book with what they're doing, and a lot of it is being led by that man, Kevin De Bruyne. So Chelsea fans, who did have him as a player before he was sold, how must you feel?
Good one, Mourinho.
Yeah, so that's my outstanding display, because he is absolutely class.
He's been world class for the last sort of year and a half.
Oh yeah, he's on another level. And again, a really humble and seems like a genuinely nice guy, yep, as well.
Yeah.
But on to feel good story.
You might have already heard that Marion Bartoli, the 2013 Wimbledon champion, is coming out of retirement. She gave up shortly after winning Wimbledon because she said her body couldn't cope with it. But the reason why I feel this is such a feel-good story is that in 2016, we started seeing Marion, because she was doing a lot of fashion work and a lot of TV appearances, and she just seemed to be losing so much weight. And then there was a lot of circulation and speculation that she had some sort of eating disorder, and it turned out that she just picked up this mystery illness that, you know, she couldn't eat, she could only swallow certain types of liquid, she couldn't even bathe in tap water, it had to be mineral water, and she didn't have a clue what was going on, and she was actually banned from taking part in the Legends match at Wimbledon 2016 because they feared that she would have a heart attack or a cardiac arrest on court and die, and they didn't want that on their conscience, which is a bit of a joke. But she's overcome this illness. She's looking healthier than ever, and she's now coming back to playing. And she said, I think she's sort of at 80-90% technically of where she was when she won Wimbledon, and at 60% physically. But she said, you know, the rate at which she's getting better, she feels like she could be at, you know, her level at Wimbledon winning levels before too long. And you know, to see someone who's had such a horrible, strange illness, you know, that could have killed her, and
yep,
to see that she's finally managed to overcome it and is now getting back to her best is fantastic to see. And you know, she's still very young, she's still got a lot of tennis left in her, so you know, we wish her all the best.
Absolutely. And if there are more triumphs and trophies to come, that'll be one hell of a comeback and a massive feel-good story that she's able to get back to doing what she essentially loves.
Yeah, and it's a nice Christmas present for her as well, to be able to say that she's well, she's healthy, and now she can go back and doing what she does best.
Absolutely.
Play tennis and winning things.
And on that note, we will finish up this first part of this episode of Sportspiel, but stick around, because after the break we have our feature interview section with steeplechaser Rosie Clark. But to introduce his guest, it's Mr. Will Moulton.
I'm sure Rosie won't mind me saying this too much, but she sort of burst onto the scene at London 2017 in not the most positive of ways. She had a couple of falls, unfortunately, in her heat, but the spirit she showed to get up and still continue running, and you know, she wasn't actually that far off qualifying for the next round, was quite inspirational to me. So when we managed to get hold of her and get her on, I was really excited, and we had a good chat about, you know, London, sort of taking up running at the age of 18 seriously for the first time and how she's progressed. And we had a good chat about sort of genetics and whether it's, you know, natural talent or if it's a training or both. The diet needed to be an elite athlete, and just sort of everything about her career so far. She's a really interesting character, really bubbly, really friendly. So definitely stick around for that one.
So welcome back, listeners, to the second part of Sportspiel, where once again it's time to chat to another sporting star. We've been lucky on this show to have had plenty of track and field talent in Sammy Kinghorn, Rhys Prescott and Steph Reid already. And now I am thrilled to say we are joined by 3,000 metre steeplechaser Rosie Clark. Welcome to the show, Rosie, and thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to having a good chat.
So am I. And it's fair to say that in track and field, you know, you get some of the field events are pretty weird. I'm thinking sort of pole vault and maybe the hammer throw, quite strange. But when it comes to the track, normally it's just people racing on a track. However, the 3,000 metres is a slightly weird one. How did you get into it in the first place?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably one of the strangest track events going, what with the water jump and all the extra hurdles. I got into the steeplechase a year and a half ago now. Two and a half years ago. I started competing at it a year and a half ago. I had been studying over in America for my master's, and when I came back from the States, I decided to move to Loughborough to be with my partner, John. And with that move came a new coach, and he is David Harmer, who's my current coach. And we both decided that the 3,000 metre steeplechase had a lot of opportunity going as an event in our country, and I fancied a new challenge. So we kind of decided to train for it, went for it, and it's been going pretty well.
Yeah, it has been going very well. Over the sort of the 18 months you were doing it before London 2017, you've already sort of leapt up to the best in the country. I guess when you made that change, was that something you were expecting, to get to the top so quickly?
Oh, I wouldn't say expecting at all. Don't really see it that way. But I've always been someone that will work incredibly hard. I kind of pride myself on my work ethic. And being up in Loughborough, it means that we kind of have a lot of the expertise and resources available to us. So making the transition from a complete newbie in the event to where I am now has probably been, I mean, it's been in no way seamless at all. I've had a lot of falls and things like that, but everybody's helped me so much to get there. And yeah, the amount of success that we've had in such a short period of time has been great. I just hope we can continue to build on it.
And it's sort of moving up a distance. So before you did 1500 and 800 metres, how hard has that been to make that transition, almost doubling the length you're running?
I can't explain how hard that first winter was when we decided to move to the chase. As you said, I only started running properly when I was about 18, when I first went to university in Bath, and I just really got on with the people at the club and just got into running, really. So dabbled in the 1500 and the 8 because that's what all my friends were doing at the time. Then when we started training a bit more seriously and when I moved to Loughborough, I was trying to keep up with the likes of like Bobby Klain, Stevie Stockton in training over cross-country sessions, and they were just absolutely destroying me, like week on week. I'm pleased to say it has improved a lot since then. My endurance has taken quite a long time to get better, but it's now probably one of my assets, I would say, on the track. We've done quite a lot of work to try and nurture my speed, but it's more through conditioning in the gym and just by adding on some faster reps at the end of sessions, whereas the focus has definitely been on building that aerobic endurance. And I think we're getting there. There's probably still a long way to go. It's good to have something to work on.
And you mentioned there you didn't take up running until you went to the university at the age of 18. So had you not really done any athletics before then at all?
I was a member of my local club, which is Epsom and Newell Harriers. Mm-hmm. And I used to go down as a kid and I did the high jump. Mm-hmm. I was always like quite sporty. I played lacrosse and netball and I swam at school and things like that. But I didn't train properly. I was enjoying being a teenager, I suppose. I'd always pick things up really quite quickly, and I'd never really tested myself. So I guess, yeah, I didn't start training properly until I was at university, yeah.
And what was there sort of one specific moment where you realised, actually, I'm quite a good runner here, or was it just sort of you just gradually got into it?
I managed to somehow second at the Indoor British Championships. I can't remember what year that was. I think it was 2013, which, A, was completely unexpected, but I also ran a huge personal best at the time over the 1500 in doing so. The guy that was coaching me at the time was completely bemused. I don't think he had any idea that I was going to do that. I was very much a recreational runner with my university. So from there, I kind of realised, oh, maybe we're onto something here, and started to, focus on it a little bit more. My family and my partner, John, have always been quite supportive and kind of encouraged me to see how far I could take this. So I'm really pleased they did, because I love what I do now.
That's fantastic to hear as well, and it's a testament to how hard you've worked then, I guess, that from 18, having, not done much running before, to now, just a few years later, you've run at a world championships. Could you sort of ever have imagined how quickly you would transition up the ranks?
Yeah, I mean, my first race for the University of Bath, I don't think I broke 5 minutes to the 1500. So, there's definitely been quite a lot of progression over the last 5-6 years.
And one thing I'm always interested to know, especially with middle distance sort of running events, is it genetics or is it training or is it both, in your opinion, that makes someone good at sort of middle and long distance athletics?
That's interesting. A lot of people seem to come from quite sort of, well-stocked genes, if you will, when you take like a Jake Whiteman or anyone like that, and an Ailish McColgan. But for me, I mean, my mum is, she's running marathons now, but more by her own admission through me having got her into running since I started doing it. So no, there's not really a sporting background in my family. I think I'm just quite stubborn and want to do well, so I've just kind of got cracked on with it.
That's fair. And you mentioned your mum there. I've seen a few things on social media, you sort of supporting your mum at marathons and stuff. Do you try and get out and watch her run as much as you can then?
Yeah, I do actually. She only started running in the last 3 or 4 years, which is, she's doing fantastically well, bless her. I was out in Berlin to watch her in September, so I really enjoy watching my mum run, and it's nice to have that level of understanding between the pair of us now. Obviously it's at a completely different level, but she gets what I'm trying to do, and she's very, I wouldn't say she's overly involved, but she's always there if I need the support or just somebody to sound off to occasionally.
And of course, it's not just her that's having all the success, it's you as well. 2015 in particular was a big breakthrough year as you sort of earned your first place on the senior GB team. And that came after, as you mentioned earlier, sort of the training in America. What was it about the training in the US that really sort of propelled you and helped you?
I think training among the team, I was at Iona College in New York, was fantastic. I had guys, girls, wherever I really needed there to sort of pull me along, and that really helped. But also that year when I was in the States, I think I grew up quite a lot personally, kind of realised that I really wanted to make a go of this, and it went from being kind of a hobby still to, no, I want to see what I can do and I want to try and make a career. I'd never really considered making a British team before, and then I set my sights on that European indoors of 2015, and when I finally got that best, I was like, okay, no, I think I can do more still. So that year definitely kind of cemented for me that I wanted to give this a real shot rather than coming from America and going into full-time employment and things like that. So I guess in that sense it was quite life-changing. Training-wise, it didn't really change that much. I was still coached by my coach back in the UK, Tom Watson, so I was still working in the same way, which is probably a couple more years under my belt.
Mm-hmm. And you came back and had that first European Championships. You then did the Euro Outdoors in 2016, and then in May of this year, I think it was, you found out you qualified or selected for London 2017 World Athletics Championships. When you found out you had a place on the team, how did that feel?
Oh, that was amazing. It was one of those ones, like, when you've been working towards something for such a long time, like, the Europeans was amazing last year, but obviously the majority of athletes in the country were working towards Rio, and for me, that was a year too early. Taking on a new event and trying to run an Olympic qualifying standards might have been a bit of a big ask. I tried, but it didn't quite go to that. So making London was amazing, and it being in London and in our country was just, the atmosphere in that track was amazing. I didn't have a great run, which I'm sure you'll touch on, but I would have been able to perform as I did had it not been for that crowd.
And yeah, as you mentioned there, unfortunately your run didn't quite go to plan. Apparently that was the first time you'd ever said you'd actually fallen in a race.
Yeah, it was. So I'll give a bit of that down. I fell twice in the World Championships heat, which was obviously not ideal in any situation, but in your biggest race of your career today is really not the best time to do it. Prior to the championships, I actually suffered quite a bad injury. I had a stress response in my fibula, which had meant I had to sit out a few weeks of running, for one thing. I was on the bike and trained very hard, but I couldn't run. But one of the major factors was I couldn't practice a water jump prior to competing at London. So I hadn't water jumped since May, and then went to compete in August. So I think a whole combination of those things, it didn't lead to my finest performance. But I'm still proud of how I managed to compete still, and I never gave up at any point in that race. I was still trying to qualify, so couldn't quite manage it.
Well, I remember actually I was actually watching your race live at the time, and despite the falls, I remember being so impressed that you actually just got up and carried on as though nothing had happened, and the crowd gave you a fantastic reception as well. That must have helped you through.
Thank you so much. It means a lot. The crowd were phenomenal. Like, watching it back, I was kind of blown away. You realise it at the time, but I think you're also in a bit of a daze. And then when I watched it back, I thought, oh, wow, no, that really was something special. And it spurred me on to go for better things next year, so it's all good.
And the water jump itself, just how hard is it to, you know, you're running 3,000 metres and you've got to go over a pretty nasty hurdle into water. I mean, how difficult is that?
So up until London, the water jump had always been like one of my strongest parts of my race. Mm-hmm. I picked it up as a skill really quite quickly, which was fortunate because a lot of steep chasers struggle with it. I think it's a lot easier the first couple of laps than it is in the last couple of laps, for sure. But that kind of depends on how your race is panned out. My main piece of advice with the water jump, which was something that I didn't follow through with in London, would actually be just not to show it any fear and not to be nervous of it. If you attack it like you do any other part of your race, then it doesn't normally give you any problems. The only issue that can come into it is obviously you have no control over what anyone around you is doing. So if you do have like women or men or anything that are timid on the water jump or can't really perform on it, then that can really knock you off your stride, and that's something that you have to be able to deal with. But other than that, I think it's actually okay. I normally enjoy the water jump. It's just a shame that I didn't on that occasion.
Well, yeah. Obviously, London 2017 wasn't your greatest, but you hit back in front of a home crowd superbly at the Diamond League in Birmingham shortly after. I think you set a personal best and a time that would have actually won the world title by 11 seconds or something like that. So, how chuffed were you to come back and sort of prove to the British fans that, you know, this is me and I can run properly really quickly?
Yeah, Birmingham was a bit of a breakthrough for me in terms of my mental strength as well as London. Birmingham was the first time when I've lined up in a Diamond League and I haven't been intimidated by the people around me. I was lining up with the likes of Emma Coburn, who's the world champion in the Super J, and I was just there to race and enjoy it. So I put myself in the race and I just kept going and going and going, and I didn't really realise how fast I'd run until I crossed the line. Well, I realised how awful I felt in the last 100 metres, but I got it done. And then I looked up and I was really, really pleased to see that by just throwing myself in and being as strong as I could mentally, it had really paid off. And yeah, it was nice to come back and have such a great result following the world.
That was a huge PB for you, and we feel like, you know, you could get faster and faster and faster. I think it's Paula Radcliffe and Joe Pavey have sort of two of the fastest 3,000 metre steeplechase times. But do you reckon, you know, you could be pushing them before too long to set the fastest time?
Oh, in the steeplechase or in the 3K flat? Sorry, in the steeplechase, the record is actually held by Barbara Parker.
How is it?
It's 9:24. So I'm currently sitting on 9:32, and the British record is definitely something that I have set in my sights. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that would come off in the next year or two, but yeah.
And the World Athletics Championships itself, up until the sort of final couple of days with all the relays and everything, it was a bit of a frustrating one for Great Britain with sort of so many fourth place and fifth place finishes. Yeah. Was it just one of those things? And is it actually, even though it might have been disappointing at the time, that's a really positive sign of, you know, what is to come from British athletics?
I think it's such a difficult thing. The people that were coming forth were performing so incredibly well. And in, I think, the majority of cases, there were people that weren't expected to be ranking that highly at all. Mm-hmm. There were people that might have sneaked places in finals or maybe could have come top 10 for the likes of Callum in the marathon. So to have so many people coming forth and for so many of them to be so young, I think shows that the programme is in a really promising place. I mean, also, so many people coming forth, it just makes them more and more hungry. They're now within touching distance of the medal rather than thinking, oh, I've got to the championship and that's a great deal. So going forward, I think it can only be seen as a positive, but I understand that to the public it must have been a bit frustrating to have been so close yet so far on a few occasions.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to be frustrating, but I remember before the event at the British trials, there was a lot of sort of stick on social media and from the likes of sort of Colin Jackson and Goldie Sayers, who's saying sort of it was a bit of a joke, but there was a lot of people there sort of resting due to injury, including yourself, and then they come out and sort of put all these fantastic performances and came so close. Do you feel like the decision to sort of maybe not take the British Championship so seriously and rest so many people was actually a good decision in the end?
Well, I mean, I know there were sprinters that were not racing, but then we did so well in the relays. So
yeah.
I mean, it's difficult. I think there'll be more of an emphasis placed on the trial going forward. There's been some changes made to selection criteria and things like that with regards to trials. In my case, I was signed off by a doctor and had a stress response I couldn't
answer. Yeah, that makes sense.
I was there supporting. I was stood right by the water jump. So, I tried to kind of stay clear of all the social media stuff, but yeah.
And you say that you stand there supporting. I remember I was in the stadium watching the women's pole vault final, and the support athletes give each other, not just from not just in their own nation, but also from other nations, but in their events. I remember watching Holly Bradshaw; she stayed until the very final jump and was supporting all her competitors. Is it sort of the athletics family, not just within GB but nationwide, a really sort of close knit community?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you think the track season runs from kind of May to September, and you're travelling all over the globe to competitions, but realistically, when you get to each of these meets, you're with girls and guys that you've seen in the last one and the one before and all of this, so you get to know people really, really well. You're also away from home for such a long time, so you end up building some really close friendships, and I think it's really important to have that with your competitors. Obviously, once the gun goes, or once you start jumping or vaulting, it's different and you're focused on your own performance and getting the best out of yourself. But by having the support network around you and helping each other to do well, I think it can really bring out the best in each person individually. So, yeah, it's something special in athletics. I don't know about other sports, but it's definitely like that for us.
And then, of course, at the end of quite a successful year for you, you've had two bits of really good news. The first is that you've been given funding as an Olympic podium potential athlete. And the second is you've been selected for the Commonwealth Games in 2018. Could that sort of those two things have, could there have been anything better for you at the end of the year?
It was quite a nice way to finish up the year, isn't it? I'm really excited about going to Australia, firstly, just to say. The Commonwealth are going to be fantastic. I've never been to Australia, and we actually have an Australian athlete that trains in our training group, so it'll be quite interesting to go over and see her side of things rather than her having to come to Loughborough all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then with funding, that was so obviously it's something I'm incredibly grateful for and thankful for, but I'm incredibly pleased with my coach as well, because he put so much time and work into us as a team and working on my progress, and hopefully it'll make his life a little bit easier now, which he definitely deserves.
And one thing about coaches is you always see events like athletics, and it seems so individualistic, but you must spend so much time with your coaches, how close does the relationship between the coach and the athlete become?
I mean, like, David and I will squabble like brother and sister sometimes. Been commented on in the past. I mean, I don't think all athletes are particularly easy, ever. You go through stages and things, especially if things aren't going particularly well. He has to put up with me an awful lot of the time, and I'm very grateful to that. It's a strange relationship, I suppose, because it's unlike anything else. It's like very professional, and I learn an awful lot from him. But like you say, it's a lot of time that you have to spend with an individual, and you do learn sort of like their quirks and their foibles. But yeah, I mean, David's a fantastic coach. I'm incredibly grateful to him.
Awesome. And final sort of topic and question from me. I remember reading while prepping for this interview that you are a self-admitted massive foodie. In terms of
I have a slow cooking ham in the slow cooking hamsters.
Superb. In terms of actual diet, do professional athletes eat a lot differently from the rest of us, or is it sort of fairly similar up until sort of event time, when obviously carb loading and things like that go on?
I would say yes. I don't think I eat anything particularly strange at all. But then that's coming from my own perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I would say most athletes that I come into contact with, and myself included, try to eat very healthily. Just in terms of like everything that we eat is like freshly prepared, all like mainly organic foods and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, I eat everything. I eat chocolate. I like everything. I have ice cream if I want it. Like those sorts of things. I'm not someone that would limit myself in any way. The most difficult thing I find as an athlete, actually, it's really random, is if you get stuck at somewhere like a service station.
Oh, really?
If you haven't packed and brought stuff with you, because there's often not much choice or something other than a meal deal, and that's great. But you know, you can always find ways around it when you just get a bit more organised and have some stuff in your bag. Yeah.
And do you have any sort of favourite pre or post race meals that you like to have?
Pre race, I normally go for like a chili con carne or something like that. I don't eat pasta; it makes me sick. I eat an awful lot of rice and potatoes, but yeah, that's probably like my go-to race. And then again, it seems quite a red meat dominant, but yeah, I will always have like steak and chips cooked at home after a race normally, because that's what I want. And yeah, I always enjoy it.
Well, that's perfect, and that wraps up the interview nicely. But thank you very much for joining us, Rosie. I've really enjoyed this interview, and I hope you have as well.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it was great to meet you.
Thanks again to Rosie for taking part in that interview. Like I said, bubbly, as she so kindly tweeted as well. So that must be good for you to hear.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it's always nice to hear that someone has enjoyed chatting with you and you haven't bored them.
That's always the important thing. Anyway, that is it from us for 2017.
It's been good.
It has been good.
I look forward to what next year brings.
What next year will bring. Seems weird saying next year when it's effectively 2 weeks away.
That's true.
But yes, if you haven't already, go to our social media pages, SportsSpielPod, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Email us nice things. But from us, it's Merry Christmas.
And a Happy New Year.